Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly in for Cecilia Mason. A young yoga skeptic finds the exercises aren't so bad.
I thought it was going to be boring and quiet, but not so much. The stretches were nice, and they almost all represented something.
Kentucky farmers are testing the nutritional value of hay, and that's no bull.
If you don't know what you're feeding, then you're just throwing money around. Because if you just throw hay out there, because hay is a viable food source.
And carrying on the tradition of old-time music is the goal of an Appalachian music camp.
And we said we can do this by ourselves and have real West Virginia people doing the tunes, you know, and doing the teaching. That's one thing we pride ourselves in.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. In May of this year, the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection approved the permit for a mountaintop removal mine site near the Kanawha State Forest. Since its approval, some residents of Kanawha County are concerned not just about the safety of the people living in the area, but also about the plant and animal life in the nearby state forest. Ashton Mara of West Virginia Public Radio spent time with the group working to bring more attention to the possible impacts of the mine and has this report.
About 7 miles outside of Charleston sits 9,300 acres of protected land. The Kanawha State Forest is home to hiking and biking trails, campsites, and a shooting range.
And that hillside beyond the big sycamore tree, can you see the white sycamore tree, white near the top? The mountain beyond that, it was timbered about 15 years ago or so. And it grew up pretty scrubby for a while.
Doug Woods stops his group of more than 30 Kanawha County residents to point out Middle Lick Mountain. The mountain is lush this time of year, covered in greenery and what Woods says are dozens of species of birds, snakes, and other animals. On the other side of the mountain, though, the side you can't see from the road on the eastern border of the Kanawha State Forest is the beginnings of a massive mining operation that began some 10 weeks ago. It's the site of Keystone Industries' Katy Mine No. 2.
My name is Chad Cordell. I grew up here, grew up going to Kanawha State Forest, and actually spent a lot of time on this land that's that they want to mine.
Cordell is one of many Kanawha County residents who, when they heard about the permit, decided to organize and speak out against it. They started the Kanawha State Forest Coalition, a group Cordell says is focused on educating folks in the area about what's going on near the forest and bringing voices together to help stop it. The original mine site proposal was entered to the DEP in 2009, but when it was approved in early May this year, there were some significant changes. The proposed site of nearly 600 acres was reduced to about 414. Two proposed coal seams on the side of the mountain closest to the forest were denied, increasing the buffer zone from 300 to nearly 600 feet. And the ridge side facing the forest must be mined last, quote, limiting the time the operation is visible to park visitors, says a DEP release. A total 7 million tons of coal are estimated to be removed from Middle Lick Mountain over a 10-year period. When it's all said and done, the permit requires the mine company to restore the land, rebuilding it to its original contour and replanting a number of plant species native to the site. It's that requirement to renew the mountain that brought Woods to the forest to lead a hike, asking participants to count the number of large and small trees, shrubs, and forb species along the way.
Martha, white ash.
Woods, who worked for the DEP for 33 years until he retired in 2011, explains the point of the exercise is to show people how many different types of species live in the Kanawha Forest now, a landscape similar to the mountain set to be mined, and how many will actually be replaced when the mining is over. He stopped the group to explain.
If we were to go right now up that incline, which I'm not going to do. Some of us can't do that. But if we were to do that, we'd be getting into drier conditions. So the forest is going to change a bit.
With that change, Wood says, there would be different species than what you can see from the mountain base, and a lot more than what the group had already counted.
Those numbers, crunch them all together, we have more than 100. We have 150, 160, 170, something like that. The reclamation plan calls for them to choose from a list of a handful of species so that we end up with 8 total trees and shrubs that must be planted back.
Woods tells the group even after they're planted, those species often have a hard time surviving on newly packed soil. Then he moves on to the animals, the possibility of struggling species that aren't required to be protected, or just the animals that can't save themselves, like box turtles, whose natural habitat is usually the size of a football field. As he talks, it starts to rain, and everyone crowds on the porch of a nearby cabin to wait for it to slow.
It's slacked off. Do you want to brave it, or do you want to sit here and listen to the quiet? Let's do that for a minute, because that's going to change.
That change will come from blasts as the company explodes rock faces on the mountain to get to the coal seam. Warning about the blasts and the possible fly rock are posted along the heads of some trails in the forest, as well as the shooting range.
Fly rock is, it doesn't typically come in great showers. Typically, if you get a fly rock that goes outside of the zone it's intended to fly in, it is a boulder or a couple of boulders. But, I mean, if they're blasting, I'm not going to be here, that's for sure.
David Vandylin, chief of the DEP's Office of Explosives and Blasting, says there are more requirements in the permit than just posting warning signs. The mine company must physically make sure no one is present before they blast.
In this case, we've said arbitrarily that at least 1,000 feet out, which is more than necessary a lot of times, from any blast, we'll make sure no one is in the area on these facilities. So on, like, say, the Lindy Trail, they would check the first 250 or so feet, and they'll post somebody up there and make sure no one comes down that far while they're shooting.
Vandylin and Acting Director of the Division of Mining and Reclamation, Harold Ward, both say Keystone has gone above and beyond to follow state and federal environmental regulations on this site. Members of the Knopf Forest Coalition obviously disagree. The group is passing out petitions and yard signs all over Charleston and the surrounding area, and is asking residents to call the governor, the DEP, and their lawmakers to ask for the permit to be withdrawn. When asked if that was enough, Cordell paused and then said,
"There are no guarantees. What we can do is try as hard as we can. And I think that we have a real good chance of being successful because of the connection that people have to this place, primarily. And I think we have a real good chance here."
A group of Loudondale residents who live right next to the site have entered an appeal with the DEP Surface Mine Board, separate from the coalition. Cordell says his group will continue to gather petitions to present to the governor in the next few weeks. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
And there are new developments to this story. West Virginia environmental officials have ordered this coal mining operation near Kanawha State Forest to halt mining. The stop work order is from the Department of Environmental Protection. Inspectors issued an imminent harm cessation order when they found cracks in a barrier intended to contain runoff in a sediment control ditch. It's also meant to prevent dirt and mud from the site from entering a nearby creek. DEP Secretary Randy Huffman told the Charleston Gazette the work stoppage continues, quote, until this gets fixed. You might remember hearing about the Spruce Mine, another mountaintop removal project in West Virginia that was halted by the federal EPA after the state environmental agency approved the permit. In this case, the federal agency decided the permit would have had unacceptable adverse effects on the water quality and the environment. Well, congressional leaders are trying to ensure that doesn't happen again. A House panel has passed the Coal Jobs Protection Act. The Transportation and Infrastructure Committee recently voted on the measure that's now headed to the full House. Supporters say it's intended to rein in what they call the Federal Environmental Protection Agency's overreach in the coal permitting process. It requires the agency to make a decision within 270 days of a permit proposal. It also limits the ability of the EPA to second-guess a state's decisions on permits and water quality standards. West Virginia Democrat Nick Rahal is the ranking member of the committee. He says it's a common-sense bill.
This bill is simple and practical. It does not take EPA out of the permitting process. It does not eliminate EPA's 404 veto authority. It simply defines the period of time EPA has to make that call.
Eastern Kentucky Congressman Hal Rogers is also applauding the legislation. He says the EPA's regulations have made it nearly impossible to mine coal in the Appalachian region. Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear is praising Congress for reauthorizing the Workforce Investment Act. Beshear chairs the National Governors Association's Education and Workforce Committee and made his comments at the NGA summer meeting last weekend in Washington. Kentucky's governor says the Senate approved a new bill 2 weeks ago and the House passed the measure last week.
For the first time in more than 15 years, it appears that the most significant federal workforce law will be updated to give governors more flexibility to meet the training needs of their state's workforce.
The legislation streamlines federal workforce programs and overhauls job training for young people with disabilities. Referred to as the largest one-day barbecue, the Fancy Farm Picnic is now just a little more than 2 weeks away. The lineup of speakers is almost complete. Incumbent Senator Mitch McConnell and his challenger, Democrat Allison Lundgren Grimes, are expected to face off for the second time in as many years on August 2nd. Fancy Farm political chair Mark Wilson says Grimes has confirmed her attendance, and he expects McConnell to make the trip. Wilson says the picnic's attendance could swell to as many as 20,000 people.
Normally we'll do 10 to 12,000 or so, but with all the heightened interest in the McConnell-Grimes race, and then you got the U.S. Senator Rand Paul with some presidential aspirations, and then we've got Jack Conway and James Comer, both sitting state officials who have gubernatorial aspirations.
Comer has yet to actually declare himself a candidate for governor. The lone Republican to officially enter the race, Hal Heiner, will not be invited to speak, Wilson says, because he's not a sitting public official. Just ahead, ginseng has been an important crop in Appalachia for centuries as it's prized in Asia for its medicinal properties. Now, Oriental medicine is coming to Appalachia. Two reports in a moment. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Food growers and producers can gain business from tourism, or at least that's the idea behind an increasingly popular movement to encourage food tourism. In Appalachia, food destinations are being promoted with the new culinary map put out by the Appalachian Regional Commission. The premiere of this map was celebrated at an event in Charleston, West Virginia. Roxy Todd reports.
Agro-tourism is not a new concept to Tootie Jones. A fifth-generation farmer, she raises grass-fed beef on Swift Level Farm in Lewisburg. She was one of the farmers at the Capital Market.
I sell beef all over West Virginia. We have about 14 restaurants now and several retail stores in Huntington and in Lewisburg.
Some of the stores and restaurants that sell her beef are featured on a new online map, which can be found at visitappalachia.com. There's also a print map, which lists 283 food destinations across the region. The map was distributed to tourism agencies and ran in a magazine called Food Traveler. Jones's Swift Level Farm is featured as a destination on the map.
We love having people of all ages come to the farm, and I have a lot of hands-on activities for children. They can feed the chickens and collect eggs and feed the pigs and run free in the grass and not worry about anything but having fun.
The movement to promote regional food could give farmers like Jones a boost by helping to establish their farms as tourist destinations. Yesterday's event also celebrated the work of farmers and chefs who have been behind the local food movement in West Virginia for some time.
My name is Dale Hawkins. I'm one of the owners of Fitchhawk Acres in Rock Cave. We believe local food is important for the economy of West Virginia just because that it's going to keep that money in state as opposed to being sent out of state.
Fitchhawk Acres is also featured on the Appalachian Food Map. At the event, Hawkins displayed local breads, homemade ranch mustard, and one of West Virginia's most iconic local foods, Pickens maple syrup. All of these local offerings could mean big things for West Virginia's food and tourism economies.
And on our farm, we actually are looking at agritourism as a business to actually bringing people to the farm and letting them connect with where their food comes from.
According to Mandala Research, nearly 80% of all leisure travelers list dining and other food activities as a top priority. As local food movements across the country begin to take root, and the term foodie has emerged in urban areas, Appalachian festivals, farms, and farm-to-table restaurants could benefit by promoting the region as a tourist destination. The Appalachian Food Map features businesses and events from 13 states, with events like a green bean festival in Georgia, a pawpaw festival in Ohio, and a liver mush festival in North Carolina. Although the Mountain State is known for its many festivals, only the East End Bazaar in Charleston is listed as an event on the printed map. Other events, like the West Virginia State Fair, are included on the online version, which has doubled the number of destinations compared to the printed map. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston.
An Eastern Kentucky farmers market has been named the first of its kind in the state to join the U.S. Department of Agriculture Summer Feeding Site program. Kentucky Public Radio's Jonathan Meter has more.
Initiatives like Governor Steve Beshear's Saving Our Appalachian Region and the White House's Promise Zones are focused on revitalizing the economically depressed coal regions of Eastern Kentucky. Previously announced efforts to this end include expanding the Mountain Parkway and investing in broadband internet access. Now, those efforts are growing from the ground up. Led by the Community Farm Alliance, local, state, and federal agencies and nonprofits have worked to get the Letcher County Farmers Market designated as a summer feeding site, which means they get federal money to provide farm-to-table food to children in the school district between academic years. Letcher County is one of the 8 Kentucky counties identified in the Promise Zone initiative, and about a quarter of its 23,600 residents live below the federal poverty line. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Meter.
Ginseng annually brings millions of dollars in revenue into Appalachia, but its future as a revenue option or even its existence at all in these parts is far from certain. Growers are struggling to conserve the plant and ensure the vitality of the industry. Those concerns, as well as new research that sheds light on the therapeutic qualities of the plant, were discussed at the 2014 Ginseng Summit. A small group of folks gathered at the Golden Seal Botanical Sanctuary just outside the small town of Rutland in Meigs County, Ohio, to discuss the important topics surrounding the medicinal root. Glynis Board of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
About 35 gathered, producers, buyers, government enforcement agents, and academics, to discuss relevant topics within the ginseng industry. United Plant Savers hosted the summit. Susan Leopold is the Medicinal Native Plant Conservation Group's executive director.
Everyone shares the same passion, which is to have ginseng be a part of our forest economy for generations to come.
The last ginseng summit occurred in 2008, when these various industry players met to discuss the issues they collectively face.
An early stage of something that may grow into something that's recognized to be a valid program, much like USDA certified organic. And We all know that not everybody...
That's Eric Burkhart, one of the organizers of the Ginseng Summit, addressing the group. He's an academic from Penn State University who's been researching ginseng, the culture, the industry, and the science thereof for over a decade.
There's a lot of growers, forest-based growers here, and there are a lot of issues that these growers face as they're trying to operate within what has traditionally been a wild harvested kind of industry. And so they are dealing with a bunch of issues such as poaching and lack of genetic stock and lack of institutional support or institutional alignment in terms of how they process paperwork and so on.
Demand for ginseng root in Asian markets has fueled the ginseng industry since the 1700s when the plant was discovered in North America. Since then, an ever-increasing demand has landed the plant on a list of endangered species, alongside things like ivory and shark and mahogany, species that are carefully monitored to ensure that international trade doesn't threaten their survival. But Burkhart says there's very little awareness in this country that the ginseng industry even exists in North America, let alone the threats it faces.
So, for example, everybody understands that there is a maple syrup industry that operates on forest lands, and that group of stakeholders, maple syrup producers, have worked very well with agricultural colleges and forestry schools and that sort of stuff to develop robust programs, not only around research, but around economics and branding and the appropriate involvement of departments of agriculture and that sort of stuff. And we haven't experienced that with ginseng. Ginseng is still considered very much a fringe product in most states where it's exported from. There's really no structure or awareness built around this industry. And so growers are still struggling with very basic things like the ability to harvest their crop whenever they deem it appropriate versus being bound to regulations designed for wild harvesters.
Current regulations are designed to safeguard the plant's existence in the wild. You can't harvest a plant that's younger than 5 years old. You can't harvest except when the berries are ripe and ready themselves to be planted. You have to have all your roots certified with approved dealers. And the rules vary from state to state. In the world today, the highest priced ginseng is root that grows naturally or plants that have been grown in natural settings. Holly Chittum, a researcher from Maryland University's Integrative Health Department, has done a lot of work researching forest-grown medicinal plants.
When we talk about wild and wild simulated ginseng, it's all about an export market at this point. And that's because they're really hard to grow and it takes a long time, and they're the ones that are willing to pay the money that would actually pay the, you know, the growers back for, you know, that time investment.
But Chittum is hopeful that a more robust market will develop in this country. She explains in Western or allopathic medicine, the herb is considered an adaptogen, meaning it modulates functions in the human system like hormones and immune responses. In fact, she herself uses ginseng intermediately in her own personal health maintenance routine.
The theory is, and there's a lot of research behind it that really supports it, is that it actually helps your body to just deal better with the stress response on a cellular level so that you have more energy, but you also sleep better. You know, it's also helps to level your mood out, that sort of thing. And with immune response, I think that's kind of the easiest way to show the adaptogenic effect is that if your immune is working, you know, too hard, too much, then it would kind of modulate it and bring it down. And if your immune system needs a boost, it would bring it up.
Well, that sort of sounds like magic.
It seems like that to us, because that's not how we think of medicine, right? We think of it acting on our body and changing our body's chemistry. Like the medicine is what does something. Well, in this case, the medicine is actually nudging our body to do its own work, to do what it needs to do on its own. It's big medicine here in the States, and it's especially big medicine in China. It's, you know, been used there for, they say, 4,000 years, you know.
Another summit attendee discussing therapeutic research findings was Marla McIntosh, a professor at the University of Maryland at College Park. She studies the genetics of American ginseng.
I became interested in ginseng because it's a non-timber product of forests, and since I have always worked in forestry, it's a high priority to give landowners a reason to keep their forests in forests rather than develop them and have some type of income that does not depend on harvesting the trees.
Studying and comparing ginseng populations that span various geographical regions throughout the country, McIntosh was able to determine genetically different variations of the plants. And among those differences, she found various combinations and levels of the bioactive components called ginsenosides from region to region.
And this is very important because the different ginsenosides have different modes of action. And for example, some ginsenosides are known to promote cell growth and would help in heart diseases, whereas others are known to inhibit growth, and these would be helpful for applications in cancer therapy.
McIntosh says given the genetic testing procedures and technologies available today, conservation efforts need to be aimed at preserving not simply the plant, but also the genetically diverse populations which stand to benefit us in ways we've only just begun to understand. It's an overriding sentiment at the summit, echoed by Susan Leopold, executive director of United Plant Savers, who hosted the event. She says the goals of the summit are twofold.
Conservation through cultivation. We want to have cultivated sources that people are growing American ginseng on their woodlots. But we also want to be able to have a national ginseng conservation plan that looks at protecting wild populations of genetic diversity throughout ginseng's range.
To that end, United Plant Savers is promoting a petition asking the Federal Department of Agriculture, the Forest Service, and the Fish and Wildlife Service to work to endorse better management practices, quote, that essentially mitigate climate change, enhance rural economies, and provide a sustainable source of wild medicinal plants for future generations, which has a strong cultural heritage throughout the Appalachian Range, close quote. In the meantime, folks like those at the 2014 Ginseng Summit are working to find ways to collaborate among themselves to develop and align best practices to sustain their agroforest business. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Meigs County, Ohio.
While ginseng has long been used by the Chinese, more Americans than ever before are turning to Oriental medicine and acupuncture to heal and prevent disease. Many states, including Virginia, now license practitioners and regulate the industry. As the sector grows, there's more demand for Chinese medicinal herbs, an important aspect of the practice. A new project underway to grow these herbs here is taking root in Floyd, Virginia. From WVTF, Robbie Harris has the story.
The ones on the top here are the ones that we can grow at the clinic here, but most of these are sourced from China and elsewhere on the West Coast.
David Grimsley is standing in what looks like a very clean country kitchen. He's pointing to a wall with shelves of large glass jars of what look like cooking ingredients. But this is the Blue Ridge Center for Chinese Medicine in Pilot, Virginia, and these are Chinese medicinal herbs. Instead of writing a prescription, clinical herbologists choose from what's here on the shelf to treat their patients.
This is Trichosanthes. We go by their Latin names as opposed to their Chinese pinyin medicinal name because we're farmers working with the herbs themselves and not the medicine. The pinyin, or the Chinese name, refers to the actual medicine, to the final product. With something like Trichosanthes, this is a perennial melon, and one wonderful thing about it is the skin is used, the seeds are used, the fruit is used, and the root is used, and they're all for something different.
In China, medicinal herbs have been wild harvested for thousands of years, but increasing environmental pollution, over-harvesting, and sometimes unreliable quality control mean Chinese imports may not be enough to fill the growing demand for the herbs in this country. That's why Grimsley and Nate Sloan are growing herbs here on the sunny slopes outside the Blue Ridge Center.
A lot of these herbs we are going to let flower and be pollinated and grow for the seed because there is such a need for the seed for the whole country. We really want to make sure that there's enough seed available for everybody who wants to grow.
How do you know about that demand? What's your evidence that there's that demand?
Because we've called around looking for seed and it's hard to find. And so we just have to use what we have, which is a wonderful thing.
Jean Giblet owns Highfall Farms in New York's Hudson Valley. She's been growing Chinese medicinal herbs since 1993. She heads a nonprofit foundation and is a member of the Eastern Forest Chinese Herbal Medicine Consortium.
There's a constant increase in demand because of the growing popularity of the profession. The herbs are gradually becoming more expensive imported from China, and that's because there's a wide range of quality. And, of course, no one wants to buy the lesser quality herbs.
The key is careful sourcing of the herbs and the often personal relationship between growers and practitioners who know and trust them. That's why the Chinese medicinal herb farm here in Floyd is looking to create a consortium of Appalachian medicinal herb growers who meet the standards. Nate Sloan.
Ideally, we would be branding our own name of product, kind of more of like a rootstock or a seed that we can stand behind our product and we can then supply our region.
Some of these herbs have been growing here at the Blue Ridge Center for the past several years, but this autumn will be the consortium's first harvest. Sloan and Grimsley are project directors for what they hope will be a growing number of certified Chinese medicinal herb farmers around here.
One thing to know about it is we're not trying to be competitive about this. We are throwing it out there to the farmers, saying, hey, if you want to diversify your crops, we'd love to help you.
In part two of our report, we'll take a closer look at how Chinese medicinal herbs are grown and used in traditional Chinese healing practices.
You know, this is, I feel like, a very interesting time to be alive, because I feel like we're taking the wisdom from many different cultures and bringing it together as the American experience, and hopefully it's a more global experience.
I'm Robbie Harris.
Central Kentucky tobacco growers this summer are feeling the impact of the unseasonably cool weather. As Kentucky Public Radio's Stu Johnson reports, growers may also feel the effect of decisions made in the boardroom.
Fayette County Extension Agent for Agriculture Nick Carter says warm weather is best for growing burley in July, but Carter doesn't expect this week's cool snap to slow growth too much. He adds consistent rainfall across the farmland has been hard to find.
The thing that's really unique about this year, it's so spotty. I mean, you may drive a mile down the road, have good rain, your farm may not have had any rain. Now, that's the variability that we're seeing.
Carter says tobacco farmers' ears may perk up following the news of a possible merger of two big cigarette giants, Reynolds and Lorillard. The ag agent says any kind of restructuring is always of concern to growers because it can impact company buying decisions. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Stu Johnson.
Making hay in Kentucky has more to do with science than with what the feed looks like, and that's no bull. Knowing what's inside their hay can save farmers dollars and help produce healthier livestock. Once again, here's Stu Johnson with Kentucky Public Radio.
Drilling for core samples and bales of hay is becoming a tradition at county fairs across Kentucky. Kimberly Field is a 4-H tester for the State Department of Agriculture. She took samples as part of a competition at the Lions Club Fair in Fayette County. Besides bragging rights, Field says gauging the nutritional value of hay makes good business sense for Kentucky farmers.
If you don't know what you're feeding, then you're just throwing money around. Because if you just throw hay out there, because hay is a viable food source. As we have now where, you know, this is the age of a science. Hay is a science. And everything has a calculation.
Field says nutritional information about hay can be found at county extension offices across the Commonwealth. She says farmers in many neighboring states use Kentucky as their hay source. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Stu Johnson.
Have you ever tried yoga? Seem kind of intimidating? Yeah, me too. Well, stick around for the next segment and hear testimony from a pretty convincing sixth grader. You're Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Long before website banners, TV or radio commercials, and electronic billboards, there were murals. Coca-Cola Consolidated is working to restore its faded advertisements or ghost signs across Appalachian states. One of the largest murals so far was unveiled this month in Hinton, West Virginia. While visiting for the unveiling, I learned that these signs still have a strong marketing value, but also a strong sentimental value.
You always have to hold the Coke, see, out.
A small crowd armed with plenty of free small glass Coca-Cola bottles gathered to celebrate a restored advertisement for the iconic brand.
Before the world-famous sign in New York City and Times Square, there was the sign in Hinton, West Virginia.
That's Lauren Steele, Senior Vice President of Corporate Affairs for the independent Coke dealer that covers the Southeast.
So you can say that sign in New York was a ripoff of the sign right here in Hinton, West Virginia.
It seemed some folks really showed up to the unveiling ceremony for a free cold sugary drink, but either way, Coke was in the spotlight. The mural stands 17 feet tall and 60 feet wide, one of the largest ghost signs restored by Coca-Cola Consolidated. It's one of thousands of Coca-Cola ads painted at the turn of the century, many of them in the rural South. The company has restored about 15 murals across three Appalachian states so far, with plans for at least 15 more. George Manahan with the Manahan Group, a marketing company in Charleston, says it's smart business because of the nostalgia Coca-Cola inspires.
I think Coke is the only brand or one of the only brands that really could get away with this. If you owned a building and someone else came up to you and said, hey, we'd like to paint a Pizza Hut on your building, you'd be less likely to do that than you would probably Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola won't say how much it's spending on the ghost sign project, but Manahan says he recently paid an artist $2,500 to restore a mural on a building in Charleston. Multiply that times the 30 in Coke's project, and you get $75,000. The Coke murals are a bit larger, so let's say we add a little more to the grand total. Still, Manahan says that's just a drop in Coca-Cola's marketing budget, and it's well worth it.
You say that new refurbished logo is going to stay on that building for 5-10 years, then they're getting a lot more bang for their buck. They're getting the PR recognition, and they're also reaching out to small communities for brand loyalty. I think they win-win-win on this one.
This mural was painted around 1916 in Hinton, a railroad town that by 1929 had 3 national banks, 2 hospitals, 10 wholesale firms, and 75 retail stores. Like other towns across Appalachia, Hinton now deals with a drug epidemic, empty storefronts, and a high poverty rate. For Arnold Lee Johnson, the Coke mural is a reminder of Hinton during happier heydays in the 1940s when he could buy a hot dog and a Coke for 15 cents.
People from the country would come, you know, shopping, and they'd had a little fruit markets and all set up. And now it's heartbreaking to see nobody on the streets.
He's happy to see the mural that towered over him and his childhood friends restored.
It wasn't new. It was getting old in the 40s, but we'd look at it, and you know how kids are. We would look at that big sign there, you know. But I never dreamed that this day would come I would be down here with it being restored.
Johnson hopes the restoration of the mural will be the beginning of the revitalization in his hometown. And it's that type of emotional connection that Coca-Cola is banking on. Again, company official Lauren Steele.
These ghost signs are definitely part of Coca-Cola's history, but they're also part of the history of the town. These ghost signs are proud landmarks in the communities where we serve, and this sign in Hinton is going to be a beacon of a renewal of Hinton.
The mural artists are taking a break during the height of the summer heat. The next restoration project will start up in early fall. That's not all that's happening in Hinton this summer. Some of the kids recently tried yoga. Yep, yoga. It's just one activity children can try as part of a summer program. Jared Klein of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
It's mid-afternoon here at Hinton Area Elementary School. It's July, but the classroom is packed with around 20 children listening closely to their yoga instructor.
So take your great big breath in when you reach up.
Instead of being stuck at home, these children are learning about nutrition, physical activity, cooperation, and making friends as part of the REACH program, which stands for Reaching Everyone to Assist in Creating Healthier Homes. Ian Gardner will be entering sixth grade. This is his second year in the program. He says that he was originally unsure about some of the activities, especially yoga.
Some stretches I did here were some stretches I thought I would break some part of my body for. I really did. And the day I started flexing, I was like, wow, this is cool. I mean, I thought it was going to be boring and quiet, but not so much. The stretches were nice, and they almost all represented something.
But it's not only physical activity Ian is learning. He's also finding new ways to eat healthy. The program provides nutritional foods at breakfast and lunch. Ian says some of the food, which he refers to as the good stuff, came as a surprise to him.
I learned about some green foods I never thought I would like peppers and stuff that were green, the green peppers and orange. I never thought they would be good. I mean, they just looked weird and they felt weird. And then I came here and I was like, wow, it's pretty good and it's healthy because school feeds you healthy food.
As the REACH Family Resource Center coordinator, Amanda Gill says it's this type of appreciation that motivates her to continue her mission to complete her degree in elementary teaching.
And to see some of these kids, they say, wow, you care about me. You made a difference in my day, and I really like coming to your program. It just makes you feel important and like you're making a difference.
The program continues during the school year with after-school tutoring and a free meal. And for those of you who still aren't convinced about yoga, Ian's got a few words of advice.
For people who haven't tried yoga, I mean, it's a very nice experience if you have not tried it. I mean, I thought it was kind of girly before I even tried it. There's all kinds of neat and cool poses that almost everybody would probably like, so I encourage you to try it.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jared Klein in Hinton.
Children with disabilities had the opportunity to learn how to ride a bicycle thanks to a camp at Marshall University. Clark Davis of West Virginia Public Radio explains how the camp helps them learn a skill that's tough for many kids with special needs.
Marshall University's School of Kinesiology hosts the annual Lose the Training Wheels Camp, along with the nonprofit I Can Shine. The program uses special bikes that allow the students to gain confidence in their riding ability, learning how to balance their weight with the appropriate speed. Kevin Crenshaw is with I Can Shine.
We have a way to teach kids and adults with disabilities how to ride a bike without other common methods such as training wheels or taking the feet off the pedals and having them scoot. This equipment helps level the playing field and gives our riders a opportunity to learn in a more gradual and more safe way.
Students ride with I Can Shine members on tandem bikes and then by themselves on bikes that do not have training wheels, but instead have a wheel on the back that looks like a baker's roller with a gradual grade. As the week progresses, the grade increases and students begin to find the right balance with the appropriate speed until they're riding on their own. According to I Can Shine, 80% of participants are successful. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
And still to come, some true country music. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In Pocahontas County, West Virginia, the week-long old-time music workshop Allegheny Echoes just wrapped up its 17th year this past June. Allegheny Echoes is like a summer band camp for old-time musicians, and the Traveling Two-Night Team Project brought back some of the sounds and voices from this year's workshop.
For 1 week each June, Marlinton, West Virginia lights up with the sound of fiddles and banjos. The week-long workshop, Allegheny Echoes, attracts nearly 150 students each year to the mountains of Pocahontas County to play and learn traditional West Virginia old-time music. The epicenter of Allegheny Echoes is the Marlinton Motor Inn, where classes are held and students are lodged for the week. Every night after the workshops, the students and instructors can let loose, and it's not uncommon for informal jam circles to last well into the night or the morning.
Yeah, it usually starts picking up after 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. Typically on the Friday nights after the instructor concerts, it's not unusual to see a lot of the musicians play until like 3 or 4 in the morning.
That's Lee Klein. Lee's from Lynchburg, Virginia, and spent his 12th consecutive year this June at Allegheny Echoes. He's devoted different years to different instruments, including the banjo, fiddle, and vocals. It's also a family gathering for Lee. His brother Billy has been coming for 17 years.
And of course, my wife's up here. She takes vocal. She used to study the fiddle up here. We don't take a week off or anything else other than come up here. This is what we like to do.
I left the motor in parking lot at 11 p.m., just as the jam circles were really getting going. The next morning, I joined one of the Allegheny Echoes classes for an unexpected field trip.
All right. So then, the rest of what we're going to do is...
My name is Jake Crack. I'm from Pocahontas County, West Virginia, and I'm teaching an advanced fiddle class this week. Our last day, I always take the class out for a little field trip, and so we're having class up at the Big Spruce Overlook here on Black Mountain. Kind of appreciate nature and learn our last tune and review everything we've done for the week.
Jake Crack is one of the country's most renowned young fiddle players. He began learning as a child and studied for many years with the older generation of West Virginia's fiddlers. Jake's been winning competitions at the nation's top old-time festivals for over a decade now. Each morning at Allegheny Echoes, Jake instructs his class in advanced fiddle technique and teaches them a new tune.
The way I like to do it is I give everybody a couple, I'll play a couple tunes and let them choose, do you like this one better? Because my thought is when you're learning a tune, it's much easier if you enjoy the tune you're learning. So I give them an option and then I'll play it for them up to speed and I'll slow it down as slow as I can play it. And then we'll start breaking it out into phrases and we'll learn it a phrase at a time and then combine it all and then repeat it.
Although a majority of Jake's students are older than he is, a significant number of younger students are represented at Allegheny Echoes as well.
I'm Claire Masesso. I'm 19. I'm from Pocahontas County. Lived here my whole life. And I've been coming here for 6 years, I think.
I'm Christian Moore, and I'm 12, and this is my first year here, and I really am enjoying it. My favorite thing about Allegheny Echoes is just that learning how to get better at the fiddle, and it's just be able to play along with other people and everything.
Claire and Christian reflect the younger generation of musicians that Allegheny Echoes strives to include. Dozens of scholarships are awarded each year to young West Virginians who are interested in learning old-time music.
We have a scholarship program. Any kid from Pocahontas County, we try to get in free. West Virginia, we try to get all of them in free.
Mike Bing plays mandolin in the Bing Brothers Band and helped found Allegheny Echoes back in 1997. Continuing the West Virginia tradition and style of old-time music is one of the missions of Allegheny Echoes.
I taught at a couple of the other music camps, and they were in West Virginia, but they didn't represent too much of West Virginia. And we said, we can do this by ourselves and have real West Virginia people doing the tunes, and doing the teaching. That's one thing we pride ourselves in, is having, over 80, 90% of West Virginia. We have to mix it up. We can't just have the same people everywhere, but we mix it up and have some out-of-staters, but mostly we're West Virginia people doing West Virginia music.
This story was produced by Dan Schultz of the Traveling 219 Project. The project is a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with support from the West Virginia Humanities Council, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and AmeriCorps Vista. To learn more about this story and hear more from the road, check out traveling219.com. Finally, we leave you today with a song from another old-time country jam session, also in West Virginia, in Raleigh County. This group meets every Tuesday just to jam and preserve traditional Appalachian music.
Everywhere I go, I'm headed.
out more about those folks, you'll have to come back inside Appalachia another time. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, WHYY in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD Land of the Sky from Maggie's Music. Other music heard on today's show was by Andy Agnew Jr. of Barlington, West Virginia, from his album Originals by a West Virginian. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is also available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.